Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Every week, we want to have honest conversations about what it means to be in one of the sector's least understood yet most critical roles. Today, my guest is Melissa Pierce. We don't have much of an agenda to talk about, but we'll keep the conversation going, right, Melissa? Melissa, you want to tell us a little bit about yourself and the organization that you work for?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Jason. Yeah, so I am the philanthropy officer for Rise Against Hunger. Like you said, we are a food insecurity organization hoping to eradicate hunger by 2030 across the globe. So we're headquartered here in Raleigh, North Carolina. We're across the country packaging meals that get shipped across the globe to the world's most vulnerable. And we also work in spaces with emergency relief and tackling the cycle of malnourishment and chronic hunger. And I've been doing fundraising for about 15 years, working in the health field with HIV, working in LGBT advocacy, most recently with the Red Cross and humanitarian work. And now I'm very honored to be a part of the Rise Against Hunger team.
Yeah. So Melissa, before we hit the record button, you briefly shared with me that the reason fundraising sort of made a lot of sense to you was because somebody was generous towards you and your family or to a child or something. Can you share that story with me real quick?
Oh, yeah, I'd love to. Thanks. So when I was a single mom many years ago, more than 15 years ago, extras for my family wasn't an option. And the YMCA offered my now oldest child a just a little soccer scholarship. No big deal. He got to play for maybe 8 weeks, but it changed his world. And it kind of changed my world because it was the first time I knew what it was like that to feel what it feels like when a community wants to come together and lift everybody up. And something that simple kind of changed my trajectory. And I wanted to be involved to help other people have that experience. So it was just total eye opener for me, not just for my son, but just kind of what people can do when they come together.
And what sort of professional career path were you on at the time? I mean, did you, before fundraising was what you were going to do, what were you going to do otherwise?
Yeah, so I thought I was going to be in education. I'd gone to college and, you know, got a degree in history because who gets a degree in fundraising? I thought I'd take this education path and this was, in the late 90s. So, motherhood and stuff like that changed the path. And I just didn't know what I was going to do, to be honest. And that's how I discovered this.
And it just makes a lot of sense. So you were going to be an in the classroom teacher.
That's what I thought.
Yeah. Is there something that in your day-to-day work raising money that sort of aligns with what you thought you were going to be doing? I'm trying to sort of bridge the connection between what you would have been doing in the classroom versus what you're doing out in the field raising generous gifts. Do you ever contemplate those similarities?
You know what, Jason? I have never thought about that before, but now that you're saying it, I can totally see that. You're so right, because we get the coolest job in the world, right? We get to go share with people who obviously care about their community, whether it's local or global, and we get to share with them kind of what the need is, but also what the solution is. And I've never put those two things together, but that's exactly what I could have done in the classroom. But I think also interestingly, one thing you hear from teachers often is that they learn so much from the kids, right? And so when we get to go out there and talk about what we're doing and what the need is and what the solution is, we get to learn so much from the people across the table and hear what they see as a as a solution or as an important need or whatever. So it's so cool. I never thought about that.
Yeah. So if one of the key themes that I introduced this show on is the idea that the world doesn't understand, or even the sector itself doesn't understand, the work that we do. And I guess just to sort of stretch that parallel, that relationship between teaching and I suspect there's a lot of teachers out there that sometimes say, hey, you don't understand what it is we're doing here in the classroom either. You don't understand how difficult this work is. But what do you think, Melissa, is that most misunderstood part about what it is we do?
Oh, wow. I don't know if you've come across this, you know, in your time and everybody you get to talk to, but I feel like in my time in fundraising, it's shifted to people really talking about us being in sales. Like even our collateral is called sales sheets. And it really seems that we get kind of put in this idea that we're salespeople going out and selling this idea. And I think the most difficult thing to really underscore and try to share with people is we're really like courting and marrying somebody, right? Over and over. We're not transactional. I'm not going to come to you with a flashy sales sheet and get you to buy into an idea. I think it's really hard to communicate that. I want to build a really deep-rooted relationship with you. And I want that not to be a you and I relationship, but the organization and you, and really help grow an investment. So I don't know if you see that as much, but kind of been an interesting journey I've been on with that.
No, I think you, you've become a fan of the book, and I'm very grateful for that. But you'll recall in the book, I talk about that, the relationship that, or the way in which, the matchmaking website, eHarmony is a different than most of your dating websites, raises the bar, sets the expectation really high for, the pairs, the people who, you know, the individuals that they ultimately create pairs for. And I have oftentimes thought that fundraising, that's part of the case that I make in the book, is that if we behaved more like eHarmony rather than some of these other cheaper, where the bar is really low, these low point of entry dating websites, we might get better quality relationships. And that's what you're talking about, formulating marriage, you know, being a matchmaker, if you will, but also knowing that you're formulating very healthy, long-term. I love the idea that you use the marriage analogy because, I've recently said to someone, I said, I think when it comes to special event planning, we ought to plan events like weddings. And we could get, if you think, and you're the first person I've said this on the air with, so you get the pleasure of sort of hearing this on the record first.
Let's do this out.
But what if people are always saying, how do we get these events right? And I said to someone the other day, I said, what if we had special events that were designed like weddings? And what I meant by that is we're always celebrating new commitments, and we're always celebrating new long-term commitments, right?
Yeah.
So we're not asking, you know, it's not about all the people who are currently giving. It's about the new person, the new relationship. And then the other thing, go ahead. Yep.
I'm sorry. Well, I was just going to say, I think maybe we could take it one step even further to hook on that idea is, you know, we often say that a wedding lasts a day and a marriage lasts a lifetime. So it's a celebration of that day, but it's really the real work comes in then afterwards. And how does that look in the long term and what you're doing, you know, with that relationship?
Yeah. So repeat that. I've heard that before. What's the phrase?
So it's a phrase, that you hear when you're starting to get married and you're planning all that time for the wedding. It's that your wedding lasts a day, but the marriage lasts a lifetime.
Yeah.
So let's not forget, you know, let's not just have the wedding and go to the honeymoon, but let's keep nourishing the relationship 10 years down the road and 5 babies down the road.
And you know what? Maybe that's what, I'm going to simmer on that for a little while. So maybe that's what Do you think, Melissa, that that's essentially what a lot of employers, when I say employers, I mean the boards and the bosses that people like yourself are working for. Do you think, so you're relatively new in the organization you're working for. Do you think when you came into the job, you knew that it was that long-term post-honeymoon phase relationship that you were responsible for stewarding differently than your boards and your bosses thought you were responsible for?
Definitely. Right. Absolutely. Oh my gosh. Yes. I would say, you know, we all focus, keep our eyes on the prize, right? We are just ready to close the gift and move on to the next gift.
Move on to the next one. Gift. Right. Right.
Yeah. And we forget, you know, that everything takes a little bit of time and it's okay not to rush and it's okay to figure out the plan around the gift before the gift even comes in through your door, to figure out the stewardship plan, the 3 years later stewardship plan. So yeah, for sure. We're just ready to just turn them and burn them. We're like a restaurant, you know, we don't want them to sit too long so we can get a new table staff. But I think we do ourselves a huge disservice. And I think that paying attention to your retention numbers and all that is going to set you up for a greater sustainable success than just moving through our pipeline too quickly.
And it sounds like you've done enough fundraising. I think I've only been in the field of maybe 5 more years than you have, but I don't think I've ever had a donor, you know, when I've been on interacting with a donor, I don't think I've ever had a donor relationship that I've been cultivating or stewarding or wherever it happened to be in the sort of the process where the donor sort of felt like it was that, where they expected it to be that quick turn and burn sort of, I think most of my donors that I've interacted with have always sort of expected the relationship to pace and be healthy. And you know,
No, I would agree. You never lose a donor because you take time to learn what they want and where their investment and their interest lies. You definitely lose a donor if you move too fast. You could lose a donor if you move too fast.
Yeah. So let's sit on that one for a minute because you and I didn't know what we were going to talk about for a while. So let's sit on that one for a minute. So you never lose a donor. What you just said is you never lose a donor because you move too fast. Isn't that what you said? Yeah.
Oh, I said it the opposite.
Yeah. You never lose a donor because you move too slow.
Yeah. And you know, not too slow in that you're not building the relationship, but too slow in that you're not cultivating it to the direction that they're wanting it to go.
Right. Yes. Yes. Yeah. I got a book on my bookshelf downstairs that's all about the science of delay. And the author is talking about, that there's a whole science that, and what he's doing is he's critiquing our modern economy where everything's fast and efficient but there's a number of things I have to go grab the book, but there's a number of things that sort of the way that they play out in our world that if we speed them up, it really messes things up a lot. And
I'm going to have to check that book out.
It's called, I think the name of it's Delay, just Delay. And I'm sure. And then the subtitle is something like The Science of Delay or something, because it's all about the idea that, you know, as human beings, we want to do things very fast and expediently and efficiently, but the way that a relationship actually forms.
But you know, and I'll say it's fair, right? Because we have to balance this with hitting our revenue targets, right? So we got to figure out like how to do both, how to build a relationship naturally and organically to the direction that the donor wants, and how to make sure we hit our budget that year.
Well, that's where I don't think organizations diversify healthy enough. When I hear a development officer say that my boss wants me to expedite these things too quickly, it also tends to be the development officer that doesn't have a very, broad sort of You know, when I was a major gifts officer, so case in point, when I was a major gifts officer in DC, I maintained a very steady schedule of 15 to 16 meetings a month. And I raised significant dollars. I always got my bonuses and all that sort of stuff. I was doing my job. But that's because I was maintaining a very high number, 15, 16 meetings a month, traveling the country. I mean, I had the whole country to travel. But I had the right people that I was interacting with. And so the scope of work sort of resolved some of that, because if I had done half as many meetings, if I was doing half as many meetings, then the pace with which we would have expected those donors to give would have been twice as fast. There wouldn't have been another donor that I was engaging with at the time that could have filled that gap if my boss was saying, we need that check now.
Yeah. So making sure your pipeline and your funnel is robust enough that you can take the time to build the right relationship.
Yeah. So if you were going to be a school, you were a school teacher. Are you on the, what's your Myers-Briggs, if you don't mind me asking?
Oh my gosh. I think I just did it. And, oh goodness. It's like, I'm right on the border between an introvert and an extrovert. I think it was like, INTJ, INTB.
Yeah, it's interesting because I haven't gotten to know you really well, but I kind of had a sense that you were probably more on the introverted side because you introduced yourself earlier as having originally thought you were going to be a teacher. And when I was in education, one of the things that I knew, and I have met some really sharp, really talented gift officers in the last 12 months that would have described themselves as introverted. But what they also know how to do is kind of like what you and I are doing here on the call, is they know how to form one-on-one relationships just beautifully. It's one thing to feel like you have to be, the glad-handing, fella who's working an entire room, but that's really not what major gift work is all about. So I kind of got us and school teachers, one of the things we know about school teachers, anybody who's been in education, often, you close that door and he or she is going to sort of take care. They're going to steward and care and nurture that classroom of students, and that's their world. And I think school teachers sometimes are oftentimes described as more introverted as well.
So that's interesting. I actually had a conversation not too long ago about that because I think, kind of like we talked about earlier about that sales versus relationship is, I think for a long time we expected any development person, major gifts or otherwise, to be that extroverted, almost politician. You walk into the room, everybody, you greet everybody, and it's all very surface level. But I think introverts who naturally enjoy kind of more deep-rooted conversations, who maybe enjoy, really getting to stay long in conversation with somebody. I think we have a lot to offer to the industry. I think I think both do, but I think introverts definitely, we have a place here. And I'm borderline, I can do the extroverted thing, but then I need to go back to being an introvert.
Yeah, but you might be, I would have to say, and I would say this about, I got to know there was a woman on my launch team that I've gotten to know relatively well, and she would describe herself as a very strong introvert, but I know she's an awesome major gifts officer in Texas. And it's that deliberate focus. It's that ability to focus on that relationship and go deeper with that relationship and therefore have the ability to listen. The extroverted sales guy, and I'm a relatively extroverted guy, but I'm also the person who wants to be jibber jabber. I'm the guy who dominates the conversation and doesn't listen very well. In my major gift work, that's probably what got me in more trouble than anything else. Is sometimes I just didn't know how to shut up and listen and sort of take it in and sort of be okay with the. But that's also what I do a lot of with my coaching is I spend a lot of time teaching development officers, okay, learn how to shut up, and most of what you need to be saying needs to end with a question mark.
Well, and it's hard though, because I think also when we do get in those meetings, we are so excited, right, to share what we're obviously passionate about with somebody who is passionate about, you know, it's easy to get going. And, I've definitely had to do like the, you know, count out my three sentences I'm going to say and then drink my water and shut up.
Well, Melissa, I've had you for a little while. I've had your attention. But one of the things I wanted to ask you about is, so I'm coming to Raleigh to teach this seminar at St. Augustine's. And I kind of wanted to ask you, what is it that a guy like me who's coming from out of town here to be giving advice to local fundraisers, what are the things that I need to know and understand before I give a lot of advice to local fundraising professionals? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, first and foremost, you need to know that Eastern Barbecue is the better one. So start there. And then, you know, here in the Triangle, we're kind of interesting because we are a very tech-heavy organization with our research Triangle Park. The instinct is that the area would be more focused on kind of STEM work. But what I think is interesting about North Carolina, and especially the Triangle, is there's a real sense of community here and a real deep-rooted sense of act locally, think globally. So, you know, our fundraisers have come together to move mountains here in the area and do incredible, incredible work. We have some amazing organizations out of here, Beyond Just Rise Against Hunger, Jimmy T Foundation, like all these really great organizations. But they also are making incredible strides on a local impact and, on a global level and just, you know, get to know the fundraisers here. I mean, it's just a cool area.
What does you have very large institutions. You've got Duke you've got some of these larger, as I was sort of scanning the community, like the type of people who might show up for this thing, but what's the relationship, sort of the relatedness between the larger and say the smaller shops? Is there this vast sort of gap between do the fundraisers who work in the very big sophisticated shops interact with the smaller shops, or does everybody get along and relate well?
Everybody gets along. I would say though the gap would be between our higher ed, because we have, like you said, we have Duke, we have Chapel Hill, we have State, which you also need to be a Wolfpack fan, but we have a lot of higher ed competing, and I find that the disconnect between higher ed organizations and then the rest of it, you know, nonprofits, there might be a bit of a disconnect there. It's just a different, you know, different world. I think you know, through our different social groups and through the AFP and stuff like that, I think everybody comes together and really tries to move fundraising in a positive direction here in the area. But I think, you know, since I've been able to work in both the bigger and the smaller, I've always found a great sense of community. I've always felt like I could pick up the phone and call counterparts on either side and get the support or the advice or the direction and I hope they feel the same about me as well.
Does philanthropy sort of cross over, or do you see, like, does Raleigh, for example, have this sort of this philanthropic elite that is really interested in sort of contributing to downtown and that sort of stuff, or is it all crossed over with the universities as well?
Mostly crossed over, except for I think in Durham, you'll see more isolated philanthropy focused in on rebuilding and building that community and really embracing their cultural heritage. That's a lot more rich than like Raleigh and Chapel Hill is.
Okay.
But I've also seen them work really hard with other larger organizations to focus that energy and get some movements on some of that. And they've done incredible work.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah.
Well, I'm certainly looking forward to it, and it's been a pleasure to have your attention. If somebody's listening today and they want to reach out to you, how would you suggest that they do that?
Yeah, they can find me on LinkedIn. I'm Melissa Brakey Pierce at LinkedIn.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.